You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Hey, Alex.
Hello, Professor.
You know, I was having a pretty good day today. Taught a class. I've got some great students. And then I checked Twitter, and the goddamn Rock and his family had or have COVID.
Yeah, I think they've gotten better.
They've recovered from it. This
is that you're just upset about this obviously the Rock's going to beat COVID. I mean, the Rock can beat whatever he wants.
He literally can beat me. He can beat you. He can certainly beat COVID. It's just, I would say it's the relentlessness of like shitty news. Thank God that he has recovered.
So much shitty news, and a warning to everybody, just because everyone's getting really, really bored of having to wear the mask and stay inside, it doesn't mean that everything is going away. You know, you gotta really maintain boundaries, because people's boundaries are slipping.
They are slipping. But you know, there's one silver lining that I will say comes out of the Rock.
What is this, Professor?
I'm gonna send the Rock to kick your ass, your candy ass, if you call me Professor one more time.
You put the dumb in Professor Dumbledore.
You goddamn jabroni!
Little justice. Fuck yeah.
That's the only one I got, and I dropped it.
No, that's done now. That's it. It doesn't matter what's your name. ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
Pour the Rock.
Pour the Rock Johnson's Little Justice. Dwayne the Rock Johnson produces our show now. No, it's a Little Justice. We're here. You know, it's so funny. This is actually going to be a little different of an episode. We're not necessarily doing what we normally do, where we pick a theme. And I mean, we are picking a theme. And
I guess technically there's a theme, but it's, yeah.
Yeah, but we wanted to take a second, you know, in the midst of all that's happening in the world, we recently lost someone who was integral to the film industry, the entertainment industry, Chadwick Boseman. And we wanted to do an episode to just sit with that and process that and deal with that. Because it's this crazy freaking time where it's like the first thing that comes to mind is like, oh my God, was it COVID? It was not COVID in this case. It was colon cancer, which is crazy because he was so young. It's a huge loss. It's a huge loss. And so we wanted to take a moment to celebrate this man, Chadwick Boseman.
It's an interesting kind of thing to look at socially, because obviously there's so much going on in the world. Every day is a new hard conversation to have, and when something left field like this, you know, it comes out of nowhere, you know, the initial reaction is everybody posting and everybody, you know, getting, it's kind of like a caught off guard, like on social media, when you get caught off guard by something, or when there's a sudden new topic of discussion, everything gets flooded. And I think you find out in the days afterward, after all the initial, you know, everyone grabs kind of the same photos and they make their remarks. And not that it's a bad thing. It's a great thing. It's an amazing thing that everybody can collectively, you know, voice their things. But then as more information is delivered and more stories are told and more, you know, all of these things, you get this broadening sense of what it actually means, like what actually happened and what it actually means. And it's so interesting to follow. To find out that it was 2016 that he was diagnosed with colon cancer.
Yep.
And that was at the beginning of his career. This was before, you know, you think, oh, well, Black Panther was a while ago, so it probably happened, you know, after that and all that. But no, this was like before anybody even knew who this guy was.
And not that, I mean, the thing, you know, the thing that's, I think, is crazy about Chadwick is when you start digging into his filmography and his work. I mean, this guy's been working for 20 years. You know, I mean, we recently learned about him in film, but he's been, you know, he was back doing All My Children.
Really?
This is what's crazy. He was Reggie Montgomery in All My Children, but he was fired for voicing concerns about racist stereotypes in the script. and his role was recast with Michael B. Jordan.
Get out of here.
Not even joking. And yeah, from there, I mean, and also, I mean, he's not, and I think one of the cool things too is this is not just a film and television person. This is a playwright. This is a guy. So he was writing plays for a long, long time. Got awards for his plays. He also was in the lab of Holler If You Hear Me, with which, if you don't know, is the Tupac Shakur musical that came out a while back. But you know, he really has had this like truly amazing career in a very short time. So we just want to take a moment to just talk about it. Let me ask you this, Alex. What is it about celebrity deaths? Like, or not, you know, yeah, celebrity deaths. What is it that do you think hits us so hard about these?
I mean, it's kind of the common talking point, I think. You know, film and TV give everybody, and celebrity culture in general, music and sports and everything, there's a common tongue in it, right? When something popular comes out, I can go to anybody in the country right now and talk to them about Tiger King, right? Mm-hmm. Or about a famous actor, about a famous musician. It provides this kind of, you know, focus points culturally for everybody to kind of share together. And I think it can get warped for sure. You know, the celebrity worship gets out of hand, but I think that's only because there are so few things based on people's, you know, appreciation and enjoyment, things that make people happy. You know, nobody's getting revved up over politicians. Nobody's getting revved up over, you know, famous people who are not, you know, involved in something that makes people happy. You know, the same thing that, you know, that happened with Kobe and pretty much every celebrity death in the modern age is when it happens, it's a shock because it's kind of like everybody knows that person, you know, even though nobody knows them personally, everybody feels like they're connected in some way to that presence. And it's kind of an ongoing, like you just assume it's going to be there. And especially when someone dies young, you get so caught off guard by the suddenness of it.
The suddenness of it, and the fact that I also think about, especially for people who are photographed or filmed for a living, we have such a distinct picture of who they are. You know, one of the things that came up prior to his death was, you know, he was going through a lot of weight loss and weight gain, and you know, none of us knew he was sick, so people were commenting on that, like, "Ooh, Chadwick looking skinny," and they were, you know, everybody was kind of making fun of him before people knew that he was really sick. And that, I think being someone for whom you are in the public eye is just like,
and I think there's an expectation of vulnerability that doesn't exist, right? There's an expectation from the public that you do actually know what's going on, and that you want to think that you know, you know, when George Clooney goes home at night, what he's like and what his relationships are like and what a quiet conversation with this person would be like. You want to think that you have an idea because you've painted a picture of this person. I think the hard truth is that in almost every single case, I can't think of one celebrity where this wouldn't be the case. Not that they're completely different people when the cameras are off and Twitter is down, but they are different people. Yes. They are someone personal. They keep a personal boundary, whether that's a thin boundary or a thick one. And the information they choose to share, you know, they have teams of people and it proves it. The fact that Mr. Bozeman kept his illness secret from everybody right up until the end, which is astounding to think that that's possible. And then you realize, oh yeah, no, these are choices that they can make as people.
And that's one thing that I think people really need to get a stronger appreciation for is the fact that, you know, this is at a certain point, you know, when you have a certain amount of notoriety, social media in this day and age, that's your job. That is literally going to work. That is posting and doing certain things is part of your job because your job is your brand. And so you have to keep a brand alive. But who you are, you know, on social media and who you choose to be in real life and in your actual life can be vastly different people. You know, I was laughing with Sasha today because we were talking about, there was a scene, she did the musical version of Rocky, and there was a scene where they filmed the guy, our friend Terrence, who played Apollo Creed, and her as one of his ring girls getting off a plane, like as footage of them, like, you know, this is like the big challenger, Apollo Creed. Mm-hmm. And they like rented out this private jet and filmed this thing. And you realize that like this was, you know, this was really before like Instagram was like a huge
thing. That's actually a pretty big business, is
renting. Yeah.
Like real celebrities renting out private jets for photo shoots.
And I had no idea that that's like a thing that people do, that you rent out a freaking, are you kidding me? Like, what are you talking
about? Oh, yeah. Because insane. Then you pose, it's like people posing in front of Lamborghinis and stuff in the 90s. Like it, you give this idea that you're living this luxurious lifestyle. Right. If people think that you're on a plane to go, and it's literally lying. It's literally people going on a plane to give off the impression to people that they have purchased time on this plane to fly somewhere, that they've chartered it themselves, and that they live an opulent, luxurious lifestyle. These are the extents that people are willing to go through. And like, it's pretty easy to see through the falseness of it all if you just bring yourself back down to earth. But people, you have to actually consciously do that. And it's so easy to just absorb yourself in social media and think that everything that's going on is the reality, and that you're getting all the information, and you're kind of part of it.
Exactly. It's and it's, which is actually interesting, because if you go through Chadwick's his Instagram page, you see, I mean, there's a way to do it where you are being a genuine person, and this just seemed like a very genuine person. There's nothing,
I mean, posted. everything I've seen about him, and you can kind of tell, and honestly The Rock seems kind of like the same person. Yeah. You know, in between, you know, clips of people drinking his tequila, which seems to be his entire social media strategy these days. But you get the sense that he is a genuine feeling, you know, charismatic person, on and off the stage, you know, in and out of the spotlight. And I got that with Chadwick on his social media and in interview clips and in things in the news that he had done, you know, gone to the hospitals and visited, and everything about him made it seem, and the fact that he's producing creatively on the side also, right, that he's very involved in the craft and he's very involved with his family. You got this sense that he was just a good fucking person.
And that counts for something. That counts for, well, counts for a lot of something.
It does. It does. And I think that when you do it with grace also, you know, the feeling that it's not being forced, it's not for show, it's not being put up like, hey, like everyone, I hope everybody thinks that I'm a good person because I did X, Y, Z, which a lot of people do, you know, using opportunities, which, you know, again, it's not a bad thing, but it's a little false in the Hollywood sense. And just nothing I've seen about this man gave off that sense that it was anything but completely genuine.
And I will say, the, you know, he, in his genuineness, you know, I just,
genuity?
Genuine nudity.
In his genuine nudity.
Which, okay, you know, go, which is genuine nude. He's a genuine nudist. No, I can't overstate the impact that he had on people of color and on the Black community. I cannot overstate that. And
talk a little bit about that, because obviously I had a different experience when Black Panther came out than I think an entire, you know, portion of our culture did. So what, cause you were on tour at that point, and was that one of the films that you booked out a theater for and did?
Yes,
it was. Went the whole nine miles.
I went
on
the whole
it.
Nine. So Sarah was there. We dressed in dashikis, and here's, you know, this is, and I said a little bit of this earlier today. Here's the truth of it, man. You grow up and, as a young Black, especially as a young Black man, you are expected to play sports. That's like a thing. There's like a real social pressure that I felt to play sports. It's a trick. It's a trap, really, is what I'm saying, because I'm not good at sports. I'm terrible at them. And I, especially that young, I did not have a lot of coordination. So these stories.
Were you big as a kid?
No, no, I was small. I was a small. I was when I was in seventh, eighth grade.
You're a big guy now.
Yeah, when I was in seventh, eighth grade is when I really sprouted up, and that so there was a lot of basketball demand, and I tried. I just wasn't.
I can't see it.
I did. I mean, I did it. Like I was. I played. I was starting center, and like I did it. And but I was. I'm sure I was terrible. I just. It's just not me. Where I found my solace was these stories. Were these movies and these comics and I think about I was obsessed with Batman and Robin and Batman Forever when those movies came out. Like the Tim Burton ones were like a little, I never quite got into those, but I was obsessed with Batman Forever. But like truly, like Seal in front of the bat light singing Kiss by a Rose is just my jam, you know?
Amazing.
I remember.
I saw it at the drive-in. It was probably the last like drive-in movie I ever saw.
Oh my God.
Double feature with like Dragon World.
And you watch, don't talk about fucking Dragon World. You watch it. You watch it now and you realize what a truly trash
these movies
movie
are atrocious.
No, they're true. Like,
Batman Forever is only outdone by Batman and Robin, Batman Forever look like a. But the thing is, they are filled with these moments that are memorable.
They absolutely are.
These movies were good.
The Bat Card. Never leave home without
the Bat Card and the Bat Nipples.
That's when I said no. Bat Card was that's my say no point. But I look back at these movies. Yeah, no, we're still on track. Still on track. Bat Card is always on track. But I look back at these movies and I realize now how supremely white they are. And I don't mean that in the way of culturally. I just mean there is maybe one black extra in these films. And for a young black boy growing up who loved superheroes, it was a very lonely space.
Yeah.
And there just wasn't, I just didn't see myself. And I Black Panther is not my favorite Marvel movie. It's not. I think that in all of them, in terms of this first 10 years, I think Civil War is the one that has everything that I love. I think it really encapsulates. I think Civil War was like the next step of the evolution of the Marvel movie, where it's like, oh, you guys want to do this. You want to get crazy. Right. And like, you know, I follow Honest Trailers. If any of you watch Honest Trailers, it's like this really funny screen rants thing that they do on YouTube where they like do quote unquote honest trailers of movies, and they called the three phases of Marvel. The first phase is playing by the rules, like, can we do this phase? The second phase is we're getting a little more bolder phase, and then the third phase that has Civil War is like when they said, fuck yeah, I'm a golden god, I can do no wrong. And like they're just fucking doing whatever they want to do. And that's what that felt like to me. Black Panther also falls in that category, but it's not my favorite Marvel movie.
Yeah, so let me ask you, because Emin and I had this conversation about Black Panther, because you know, as a movie, I didn't think it was really much better or worse than most other Marvel movies. But what it represents.
Yes.
Right? The fact that this movie exists.
Yeah.
Talk about that dynamic.
Well, that's what I wanted to get to. The fact that you have an African king as your superhero. The fact that your story is truly about the disconnection of black Americans from Africa.
Mm-hmm.
That is literally, and that Disney lets you make that story. Do you know what I mean? Is incredibly, I mean, to Ryan Coogler's credit, and does his best to make it very subversive. There were things said in that movie that I was like, they let you say that? Because he doesn't ever say it like on,
because no executive had the balls to call it out.
Yeah. But like, it's so, I mean, he hit it, but like, if you're listening, it's there.
Yeah.
Some of these lines are just like, ooh, you really go there. You really are making a statement. And that alone was powerful. But seeing this like black man who was royal and who was evolved and who was flawed, and especially the way that Chadwick played him, it wasn't, you know, I think that Marvel heroes can either be quippy or be like stoic and militaristic.
Yeah.
And Chadwick found a way to, yeah, he, you know, T'Challa definitely falls more in the stoic version of things, but Chadwick gave him such a vulnerability.
Yeah, he's a warm stoic.
He's a warm, he really is a, he's family. He cares. Yeah. Family. And that was the first, this is really the first Marvel hero, I think, who has this in them where not, it's, you know, Star-Lord is about family. Chris Pratt Star-Lord is about family, but it's about the family he lost and is hurt because he lost it. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
T'Challa is about, I have a family and I'm going to do whatever I need to do to protect that family.
Right.
And to honor that family. And that is just such a different narrative for black people to see the, to see themselves in on screen.
Well, I mean, and I think presenting a world, you know, this is a world that exists separate from everything else, right? Instead of a story about trying to incorporate into a world that you don't fit into, it's about being strong in the world that you are in and that you know and the people you're surrounded by. It's saying it is like you don't have to be something else. You don't have to give any ground on what your voice is and what your culture is and who your people are. It is okay to have your own kingdom of you.
Yeah, of you.
And your family. And I think that that's so separate from, you know, the depiction of the black struggle in other movies, yeah, and TV shows and things where it's about running up against it. It's about how it conflicts with everything instead of just showing up, you know, a powerful group of people existing how they want to.
That's exact. I couldn't have said it better. That's exactly right. And I just think about all the young kids who come up in this era where they can see these films, as opposed to me who grew up with the Batman Forevers of the world. Do you know, right, like it just, I can't, it makes a difference. It makes such a difference. And that's why his loss is so huge, because like, you have to understand there's only so many of us that they let through. Even now, when things are better, when we have made huge strides, there's no, you know, I can't, you cannot.
Well, so we talked about Attack the Block last week. Did you read what John Boyega wrote?
Oh, recently? Yeah. Oh, well, I mean, yeah. And he's been saying that on his Twitter. Do you want to fill them in what he's been saying?
Well, so I didn't read too deeply about it, but basically John Boyega came out and talked about basically just directly addressed the fact that through the new Star Wars trilogy, he was kind of brought in and tokenized and then moved off to the side, which is absolutely true. His character was presented in the first film, in The Force Awakens, as like this guy's the new front and center hero of Star Wars. Over the course of the film, he was kind of resigned to, you know, class clown.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in a way that was like very strange.
It was very strange
for who, and like, and
I think the way he phrased it was nuance. He's like, they gave Daisy nuance, they gave Adam nuance, and I like his characters didn't have any depth. Like there was nothing
him
going on.
And this is what's really messed up. Him, Oscar, and Kelly, all of them got relegated to these roles that were like,
yep.
What the hell are you doing? You know what I mean? Like it once it, you set off with the promise of bringing us a new generation of heroes.
Yeah.
And you once again did what you have done. And in a narrative that actually doesn't need, do you mean like it would have been one? Here's the thing. Star Wars, we're not looking for like nuanced portrayals.
What right.
we're just looking for good heroes. But like what you don't have to do is like turn everyone else into like a afterthought or a joke. And like just focus in on your two white leads, like you can find a middle ground there. Do you know what I mean? And I think that he's absolutely right. And then also, I mean, like I can't imagine being at the forefront of a franchise like that and being, you know, having to deal with all the stuff that comes with that from the fans, because the fan, I'm sorry, I'm a Star Wars fan, but we can be. Some of us are vicious, and when I say some of us, y'all know who I mean. They are vicious, and they don't let up, and like you know, calling it like a social justice casting or whatever. It's like, nah, maybe he's just a good actor. Like, The kid is a super talented actor. All five of them are super talented actors. And I say that again, I would watch Adam Driver read the freaking phone book. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's not about anything about Adam Driver's performance. It's just like, if you want to truly make a space, an equalized space, you got to make an equalized space. And there's so much I could say about that, but
I get the sense with Star Wars is that because there are so many kind of cooks in the kitchen, in terms of driving the thing, and like toys are a concern and all of that. I get the sense that the executives drove those decisions a lot more than than the directors.
Absolutely.
Because the third one, The Last Jedi, had a different director at first, right?
Yeah, it was supposed to be what's his name? Gareth Edwards, who did
Who did Godzilla. Which was that was pretty good.
Yeah.
To me that's executive stuff, and so you never land anywhere actually that's going to push a threshold that's going to change anything.
Yeah.
Do you think that Black Panther when Marvel sat down to pick not only that they were going to make Black Panther, but who they were going to get to make it. Do you think kind of leaving Coogler and Chadwick and all these people together to make the movie they wanted, was that an intentional thing? And is that an okay approach or not? Like, is it kind of working against something to be like, here, like, go make this product, like productizing, you know, their storytelling because it falls into a certain...
I go back to what I said about the three phases of Marvel. You know, they it sucks because Edgar Wright came in at the exact wrong time. He should have come in these past 3-4 years, right? Because he came in when they were still like being a little trepidatious. The Russo brothers still hadn't proven themselves. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like he came in and they were still trying to just kind of improve plus the movies that they had already made, right? Yeah. So he came in with a vision for Ant-Man, and they were like, that's too weird. And then recently, now that they've like, you know, once they established themselves, like they were like, let's embrace the weird. So they got Taika Waititi in there doing all sorts of, like taking Thor and saying, let's rejigger this thing completely. You got the Russo brothers being their best selves and stringing together some incredible work in Civil War. Yeah. And then you you let loose with Ryan Coogler. And I think that specifically with him, I don't know what went on behind the scenes. What I can tell you, there's no world with Marvel Studios, there's no world in which this stuff is not passed by every executive at some point.
Oh yeah.
There's no world. That said, what I felt when I watched the movie was that they let them go. They were like, we'll pull you back, but go far. Like, go far. Do you mean you got Ruth Carter, probably the best, I mean, if not one of the few Black women costume designers of all time, but who has designed most of the Black movies that you love. Ruth E. Carter designed the costumes. And you got her on Black Panther doing like straight up African. Like, we're not even pretending. Do you mean like there is no world in which this is not an African? There's no, all of these motherfuckers are dark skinned. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like it is African, and the importance of that, and allowing the story to be told. And then like, again, like subtle things. Like I was honestly, the things that shocked me the most were the things they did with Martin Freeman's character, because like in him, you literally have the voice of the studios in that character being like, you're a third world country. It's too much, you know, pull it back, whatever. And then M'Baku barks at this guy. He literally looks at me and says, oh, 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 and like shuts him up. Like every time this white man tries to talk in this movie, they're like, shh, it's not about you. It's not about you. And like, that is insane. The culture, like that's beyond like just a racial joke. That's like, that is a statement. Do you know what I mean? That is huge. You talk about me renting out the theater, that my Hamilton cast, well, you know, 90% of us are African American or have some African American heritage. And when those moments happened, it was people standing up and clapping. There were swerves of people who went to see Avengers Infinity War solely because they knew those characters were in there.
Yeah.
They didn't know anything about the movie coming up into it, but they knew that T'Challa and Shuri were there, and they were like, I'm going to be there. That's the power of what they did. And that's why I think even if an executive at some point had their hands on it, whatever they did, that's how they should be doing these movies.
Yeah.
Because it again, embrace the directors that you have. Let them run free. Let them do their thing. And then, yeah, and then you go back through in the editing room and you say, okay, here's what we need to judge to make it this, reshoot this, do this. But like, you, at least let them be your baseline.
Mm-hmm.
And I also just think, not even in terms of representation, but like in terms of product, you just get a better product. You know, let the artists be the artists and then you be the business people. And I think that's, you know, talking about Star Wars, I think that's part of the thing too, is like whether or not, you know, was what happened to John Boyega overtly racist? We will never know. We truly will never know. We'll never know if there was a meeting where like the black guy's not testing, pull him back. Do you know, we will never be in those rooms. But what you did definitely sends a certain message. And John Boyega is right to say something about it. And beyond that, I would go so far as to say that if you had a story that was, I don't know, planned out, if you knew what your story was before you did it, then you would have been able to give this actor any sort of arc at all.
Yeah, because it's tough to say that it was any one thing with that, just because of how much of a mess.
Yeah, that was a complete mess. And granted, you know, I went back to Return of the Jedi recently, and I don't know if anybody's watched Return of the Jedi recently, but like the disparity in tone between episodes 4, 5, and 6. I mean, like it's nothing new. The only difference was those were, you know, they were somehow able to keep the through lines. The tones were
vastly. Well, they were supposed to not be. Return of the Jedi was supposed to be Revenge of the Jedi, and it was, but you know, Luke was supposed to die at the end and all this stuff, and then it was a studio thing, like, oh no, we'll sell more toys if it's happy and there's
it was
Ewoks.
Literally Han Solo literally becomes Barney the clown. Like it's
absurd.
It's truly an absurd film, and I didn't realize it until I rewatched it. I was like, holy shit, this is bad, you guys. This is bad, guys. Like bad. what did you do? And especially because you set it up with the promise of Empire. But again, like story wise, those three stories connect. Like that's what makes it work. Is like you can at least follow the bouncing ball into the different tones. You know this, but the Star Wars trilogy, it's like from the bottom, from top down. Yeah. It's just like, what the hell?
Well, so there's Chadwick Boseman through the lens of Marvel.
Yep.
And what he brought to the world in that department. As we've dug a little deeper into, because I was not familiar with maybe any of his other work.
Oh yeah,
before.
Yeah, yeah.
So what did you pick? You know, we each picked one to watch.
Yeah.
Just so we'd have a broader conversation than just Black Panther.
So
what'd you find?
I mean, so what I'll do, I'll actually do what we normally do, which is, you know, do the thing.
Set it up.
Because I mean, the filmography is not that big. I think you'll be able to get it right off the bat. We open with one of my favorite singers of all time, Marvin Gaye.
Mm-hmm.
And some shots of the 60s. A lot of shots of the 60s. Document and truly footage of the 60s. Like, this is not filmed. This is, you're seeing a lot of President Nixon. You're seeing a lot of the Vietnam War. Tiananmen Square, you see the monk burning himself in protest of the Vietnam War. Really graphic images. There's one image that there's a shot of a man who was shot by GIs in the street, and you actually see it happen. You see the last seconds of this man's life, actual footage of it. And you're just going through, and then it cuts to present day Vietnam in a hotel. I think it's called the Majestic Hotel, if my mind is correct, my mind is remembering. And there's an older black gentleman waiting in the lobby sipping a drink, and another black gentleman comes up behind him, and it's like kind of a reunion. Like, you know, you get the sense, okay, are these guys soldiers? Have they been here before? And then two other black gentlemen come up, and they're having a reunion, and they are like hugging each other, and you know, you're kind of getting a sense for who they are character wise. One of them seems a little more reserved than the others. One of them is like flashing his money around. He's apparently paid for the whole trip. One of them's like the Joker. The other one's like the smallest one's like the leader. And then they go out to a bar and they're just like dancing to old 70s music. And one of them earlier has pulled out a picture of a fifth member that you can guess is no longer with them. The man in the picture is, of course, Chadwick Boseman. And the movie is The Five Bloods.
Our platoon was ordered to find a C-47 CIA plane that went down with a payroll for the native people, the Lahu. Now, they didn't want to be paid in paper currency, so Uncle Sam was paying them in gold bars for their help against the VC. Well, we found the gold.
And we bury it, for now. They ask, we say the VC got it. They don't, we come back and collect.
You mean rip it off?
We ain't ripping off shit. Who feel like they're ripping something off? We was the very first people that died for this red, white, and blue. Yeah, that's right. It was a soul brother. Christopher Zadix at the motherfucking Boston Massacre. We've been dying for this country from the very get. Hoping one day they'd give us our rightful place. All they give us was a foot up our black asses. But fuck that. I say the USA owe us. We built this bitch.
So originally I was going to pick one of his biopics, because he's done a ton of biopics.
Yeah. I kind of want to talk about, because it's a short filmography, but you kind of see the evolution of a career. You see kind of the path that he had put himself on.
Yes.
From pre to post Black Panther.
He did an amazing job of, you know, I think it was really cool. And I didn't even realize it when it was happening, but that he was just going around playing black heroes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was such an amazing thing. And I think that, you know, Spike Lee in interviews has said that all those choices led to him being cast as this character in The Five Bloods. This character that he plays, Storm and Norman. One of the things I love about this, the Five Bloods, is that all the characters are named for the Temptations. Norman, Otis, David, Paul, Eddie. Who am I missing? Otis, David, Paul, Eddie. Oh my God, who is the Alex?
You would know.
I'm in the show.
You're in the show. Who do you play?
Oh, Melvin. Nope, it's Melvin. Melvin's who? I play Otis. But Melvin's who I'm missing. But the cool thing is that Spike Lee said that, you know, we needed this character that Chadwick plays in this movie is not, it's truly a supporting role. It's like, it's very much like that and character. You know how in movies, you know, you have like the starring and then you have the with, you know, with like featuring blah, blah. And then there's always, and it's like, it's, yeah, that's, it's like the heavy, that's the heavy, right? It's like Ian McKellen and Kate Blanchett. And this is very much and Chadwick Boseman. And he plays like the leader of this old troop in this movie. And it is really a special performance because so much of it is about him being this kind of ethereal presence. Like, he lives only in their memory. And so there's an intensity that he brings and a just a kind of like a, it's very eerie. It's very eerie to watch, because especially because this man is dead now. To watch a movie where he's essentially playing a ghost.
Right. So I haven't watched it yet. Is it, it's like it takes place in the modern day following soldiers after they've grown up and they're looking back, and it, yes, goes back and forth.
It's pretty, yes, that's exactly what it does. And it's really a treasure hunt. So the plot is, without, and this doesn't give anything away, but the plot is that as soldiers in the Vietnam War, they found treasure. They found gold.
Gotcha.
And they buried this gold and promised each other that they would come back to get it once everything was cleared and safe. And this is the four of them returning. Norman, who Chadwick plays, did not make it back. So they're also coming to pay their last respects to him. And it's that story. It's like the story of this treasure hunt. But it also just like, it just gets into issues of masculinity and of, and of black men's experience in America. And, you know, just like most Spike Lee movies do, there's so many layers to it. It, you know, sometimes Spike Lee to me is a hit or miss, but in this one is a hit. This one is absolutely one of his best films since Malcolm X. It is truly, it's a gut punch. It's a thrilling watch. I think what he also allows himself to do is, like, I think one of the things that bogs Spike down sometimes is that he gets obsessed with his social commentary, and the social commentary overrides the movie. And I find that, and this is similar to what Pete Chapman said. I think we talked about this with Pete Chapman, that Spike is at his best when he's kind of confined by genre, in my opinion. Yes. I think that when you just give him the constraints of, like, this is this movie about this, and then he finds a way to subversively put his stuff in there,
mm-hmm.
it rings truer, and it just hits you better. And this is one of those movies, because the movie is literally a treasure hunt. That is the movie. And a very, very tense and thrilling treasure hunt. And then the social commentary comes in, and you're like, and it just hits you. Delroy Lindo in particular will be getting an Oscar nomination this year. I guarantee it. It is that his performance is absolutely stunning. But Chadwick,
I really need to watch this.
You do.
So yeah, tell me about Chadwick.
What I love about Chadwick's performance in the movie, he really doesn't have that much screen time. It's very, he's in there, in their memory. It's all about his eyes. He does this thing without giving too much away. There is an intensity to him that he always brings to his characters. But particularly in this one, ghosts are very interesting things in film, because they are both there to be reminders of the person we lost, and they're warnings. And especially in this film, his ghost is a warning, and his ghost is not always like a welcome presence in the minds of these older men. And he plays this role with such a power, but all, like, it's a power that's like, you know, Spike does that wonderful thing where he has you staring straight dead at the camera, and Chadwick's eyes just stay. I can see them right in my mind. You are as in awe of him as you are scared of him.
Yeah. It's something I don't think that he can help but bring to it. Just that there, he has that, you know, they talk about like an it factor,
yes.
Something you can't quite define, some kind of power, where you don't need to say a word. You don't need to do anything. You understand where this person's kind of center is, right? You understand what they're about and what they stand for and what they, you know, the power that they have without them having to do anything. I mean, the movie I chose, it's the same thing where, you know, just him being there,
yep.
even without any dialogue, from the way that he's looking at these characters and the movements he's making, you understand, you know, what he is.
Completely. And it's
so very unique.
It's incredibly unique, and it's you know, there's so many actors right now who, especially black men, I think we're in this weird place because we are getting our asses kicked by black British men, and that's actually just true across the board. I don't think it's just for black men. I think for men in general, Brits are kicking our butt. Brits are coming in and being like, yo, we got this. Because I think that in America, I think that that acting is personality. In Britain, it's still craft. And so you have guys coming over there, Daniel Kaluuya, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing his name right.
Is he English?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. He's British, bro.
Really?
Isn't that crazy? British. Wow. British. Chiwetel
Ejiofor. I totally forgot that that Tom Holland, when I was watching an interview, that
isn't it crazy?
Oh yeah, he's British.
It's that's
and I'm watching The Wire and Idris Elba.
That's what I'm saying.
It's
insane when you have like what training will do, and there are people who are trained who stand like the person I will always come back to is Lakeith Stanfield.
Is he British too?
No, he is American, but he is trained. That boy is trained, and you see it because it's not just about. There's just a gravitas to the work, and there is a there is a depth that is not there, you know, when
he's
you're
not
just
showing up to be personality and read the lines off.
Yeah, he understands what it is to craft a character, you know.
You know, and what, that's why I don't like Chris Pratt. I think
I can get behind that.
Not that I don't appreciate it and or think that he's a talented person, but I think that's what he's lacking, you know, through the Jurassic Park movies especially, is like it feels like he is showing up to be hit a personality, and he can deliver the lines competently.
And that's and in this age, when going back to our original conversation about in this age of like Instagram and all this stuff, like that sells because, yeah, you know, these people,
right?
On Instagram.
I mean, that's a huge part of it.
That's the part of it. You want to, yeah, I don't really care about Jurassic Park. I want to spend some time with Chris Pratt. Do you mean like when Jurassic World, sorry, because it's not Jurassic Park. Because that was the thing, like right when Jurassic World or when Jurassic Park came out in 93, like, yeah, Jeff Goldblum was definitely a star. Laura Dern, like young up and comer. You know, they were trying to get Harrison Ford for Dr. Alan Grant, and then went with Sam Neill. Do you know what I mean? But like, none of these people were like box office draws. Not a one of them. Not really. You know, but now you have a Chris Pratt helming Jurassic World. And it's like, yeah, come spend some time with Chris Pratt and some dinosaurs. Do you mean like that is the sell? And so again, it's not to say that, you know, clearly the man is doing something right because he's making hand over fist. And maybe not now in the pandemic, but like, his movies make hand over fist.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's a huge part of it. I mean, as an actor in Hollywood, I'm sure you have to look at your career and play to your strengths. And there are actors who are working because they are very talented craftsmen. And there are actors that are working because they are really fun to watch. They're very entertaining and they have the right series of, you know, I don't know how you move from Parks and Rec to being a global movie star, but good on them for doing it.
Yeah.
My choice that I went with for Chadwick, and I'll set it up just so we can, it's not super important. I want to be careful with this one because I didn't really enjoy it.
That's fair.
And I don't want to disparage it. I don't want to talk about the negatives because they're definitely there, but it's an interesting, you know, I'm looking at it more in the context of this career that he was building. And these choices that he's making, where he fits into the Five Bloods, as you know, he's made a career of playing these heroes, and he fits in thematically and all that. This one's a little bit different of a choice, and I'm curious about it. So I will go through it really quickly. So we open on a church, a sermon, a funeral. It's a packed house, a lot of people there. The priest is talking about
first. Reginald found a woman as strong, driven, and smart as he. And then I think of his boy, Andre. And I see the same, sometimes infuriating, fearlessness.
We focus in on a young boy and his mother sitting in the front. It's the son of the man who's died. And he's watching, and the priest is talking about the mother and how he found this wonderful woman and how they had this wonderful son. And he's, you know, and what using his father's legacy, what this boy is going to bring to the world. Cut to present day. The little boy is Chadwick Boseman. He's a detective, and he's in front of an internal affairs investigation.
I didn't have a choice. I could choose not to be a cop. Being a cop isn't a choice for me.
What is it then?
DNA.
He's being questioned about maybe he uses too much force. Is it always justified? He's got a reputation as being trigger happy. He defends himself, you know, as saying he's doing what needs to be done. He knows who he is. He's, you know, he could never, it's in his DNA to be doing this, but you can tell he doesn't fit in with the rest of the room. That's, you know, it's cops talking to cops.
Yeah.
And you can tell that he immediately, through the way he delivers this monologue, it's like a pretty serious dramatic scene just because he's there. The dialogue is whatever. The scene is not even, it doesn't seem that important, but just his seriousness, his gravitas that he brings in swings like a hammer.
During the Civil War,
Some soldiers just kept loading their muskets without ever firing. Five or six balls loaded on top of each other. In Vietnam, only 30% of frontline infantry soldiers ever fired a shot. So 10 soldiers in battle, only three truly fighting.
Are you really using war analogies here, Detective Davis?
What do you imagine the other seven were doing?
Over the course of this first act, we follow two criminals who are going to knock over a bar. You know, there's cocaine there. They're going to steal. It goes wrong. They end up killing a bunch of police and they have to shut Manhattan down.
Mm-hmm.
Chadwick's the lead detective who's going to catch him. He says, shut down the 21 bridges.
Stray, Mama.
I need to take my meds.
No. You took home. You already took home.
You look tired. You work too hard.
You know, you got that right. It's the job. It's what I do.
I know. You gotta look the devil in the eye.
Yeah.
The film is 21 Bridges. Because I guess that's how many bridges there are that connect Manhattan to the rest of the world. So the idea is they shut the island down. It's a
love that title, by the way. Love that.
It's a great title. It's an absurd premise.
Sure.
If you ever thought about it, it's again, this is where like I don't want to get into the negatives.
No, yeah.
This movie is surprisingly 80s.
Yes.
It harkens back to an era of, you know, more bullets, more car chases, bigger ideas, you know, very Die Hard, you know, just big, you know.
Watching the trailer, it felt like a movie that Denzel would have done.
Absolutely.
You know what I mean? Like this absolutely would have been one of his starring vehicles.
And everything is done competently. And Chadwick's performance is great. But what struck me is, and what's different from literally everything else I've seen him in, is that it could have been somebody else.
Yes.
They could have cast somebody else.
Yes.
The character is not deep.
Yep.
You know, all he's got for his personal struggle is his, you know, the story with his dad who was killed by criminals, you know, and died fighting back against the criminals. And so you get kind of what drives him, and he wants, you know, the very classic, like the cop wants to fight against, you know, the dirty cops and because he's got principles and morals and, you know, fight for what's right and all that kind of stuff. And it's very, very generic in that sense. And it was interesting. It's interesting. I don't know. Fun to watch a movie like that though, because they don't really make them like that anymore.
But what I will say in line with everything else we're saying about Chadwick's career, you know, when Denzel, like I think about, what's that movie he made about with Annette Bening about terrorism in New York? The Siege with him and Bruce Willis and Annette Bening. Mm-hmm. You know, these kind of generic movies where, yeah, it could have been anyone. Like I think about Manchurian Candidate. Right. And again, great character. Could have been anyone. Did not have to be
Denzel.
Could
have been anyone.
Did not have to be Denzel. But I think that. So, go ahead.
Well, so yeah. So this felt like because of Black Panther, because of the rising star. And that's how it felt when they advertised it too. You know,
yeah.
He's front and center. Chadwick Boseman, action film, whatever. I think it's like co-produced with the Chinese. So it was kind of built as this global action movie, pushing Chadwick, you know, onto things beyond Marvel. And the cast around him is great. Sienna Miller is in it. J.K. Simmons, as always, is amazing. Taylor Kitsch from Friday Night Lights is in it, who's pretty good.
In a role that I just read was actually Chris Pratt was up for it.
For Taylor Kitsch's role?
Yeah, they were going to... Chris
Pratt. That makes sense. Again, really anybody... You know, he plays one of the two... guys who tries to steal the drugs and gets caught up in this huge thing. And it's fun, you know. Again, everything is competent, and what Chadwick brings to it, I think, is that idea whereas Denzel, he walks into a room, you know, cock of the walk, I'm here, I'm gonna fuck you up, I'm a here, you know, he plays action star as like a I'm in control and you better watch out kind of action star. Chadwick's got that vulnerability, right? He's got that quietness. He's got that. He's not going to let anybody fuck with him. He says all the right things and does all the right things to push back when he needs to and to make sure that nobody's getting in his way. He has the energy and the momentum of a Denzel-like character, but he does it quietly. He does it stoically. He does it, you know, a little gracefully. And you understand through that without him needing to prove it, which the script goes ahead and basically, you know, it's a paint by numbers kind of like, this is who I am and why I do this kind of thing.
Yep.
You still understand why he's making the choices that he does and the interactions he has with the obviously torn, you know, quote unquote criminals who actually maybe they're not bad people and they're just caught in a bad situation and he's the only one who recognizes it. It all makes sense because it's him.
You're the only cop tonight who speaks first and shoots second.
It's fucking morning, and you killed 8 of us.
Not all 8 were clean.
Who cares?
You do.
How do you know I'm any different?
Because you would have shot me by now.
But it's not enough to save the movie, unfortunately.
No. But you know. But again, I think that the beauty here is like. Look, every script that you get, every movie you make is not going to be the best movie in the world. But did you elevate the movie? Did your presence make the movie more than it should have been, than it ever deserved to be? And it sounds like from what you're saying, yes, he did that. And that is a power.
He did all he could. He did all he could. And I mean, it brings up, there's, you know, the other aspect of all this, obviously, that we should talk about. You know, we can't know anything for sure, but from 2016 on, he was battling cancer,
which is a
fight that drains you not only emotionally, knowing the fight that you have ahead and a potential outcome, but physically going through chemotherapy and you know all of the weight loss and all of the just you know I've seen family members go through colon cancer. My aunt passed away from colon cancer and watching the progression of what that is, by the end, it's hard to get up and get out of bed. And to run a career, not even keeping people in the dark about it, but just to go and all of what it takes, all of the energy that it takes to do even one of these things.
There's a school of thought that says, you know, should we glorify the fact that he, you know, kept pushing forward, because at the end of the day, you have a person who, you know, should have been resting. I mean, not should have been resting, but like he chose, let's say this, Chadwick chose to do exactly what he wanted to do. But anybody that's sick deserves to be able to rest. Mm-hmm. What this says to me, where I come down on this, is you did what you loved. That's what I love more than any of this, is like, you, if you are gonna, especially after the movies you made, dude, You got a whole studio invested in your health. All you have to do is be like, "Hey, I'm good." When that dude from Andy Whitfield from Spartacus, when he started his battle with cancer, they shut down. They said, "Cool, we're gonna rewrite. We are not filming this until you're better, bro. We're gonna rewrite the second season and we're gonna go back in time so that your character's not even in it yet, so to give you time to do what you got to do." And that was Stars. Do you know what I mean? That's not even Disney. Disney, who, like, you just made them kajillion dollars, and he chose to keep working. And that's, I view it less about like, oh my God, the strength that takes, more about you fucking loved what you did. And that's what I think is the best part. That's the thing that is inspirational to me, is like, and it's the thing that gives me hope in the midst of all this, because it's like, if there's something that you love, that you truly feel you're built to do, you find a way to do it, just because it gives you joy. And I hope for him, I hope that every moment on set was a joyful one. I just hope that every time he stepped on into work, that he, even if it was a bad day, I hope he just enjoyed the work, because that's the only reason I can think of that you would do that. And
I think it was Spike shared a clip the day or two after he passed away, of a behind the scenes, maybe the last day of shooting on Five Bloods. And it's just them, you know, they're are coming out saying, you know, we want to do it one more time, and the whole cast comes out with water guns and just starts spraying everybody, and everybody's, you know, laughing and have that kind of like, you know, that family element that you want on a set, wherever, you know, you're just ripping on everybody else, and you're out doing work, but having a great time doing it. And I think, you know, it just kind of showed that, yeah, he was, you know, he was there having fun. He was there sharing his heart and his soul with people. And yeah.
And I will say, I miss it. I miss it so much. That is something, in a very real moment, I will tell you, like, I think about that often. And there's, you know, there's a couple people who are returning back to work, in the arts, you know, getting, you know, whether they're filming up in Vancouver or, you know, people filming out of the country. But it is that camaraderie of being around a group of people and working toward the common goal on something is something I miss every day.
Me too.
Yeah. I'm very glad that he got to have that in his last years. But Chadwick, listen, we so appreciate everything that you did and everything that you are, and your legacy will never be forgotten. You know, you have in such a short time made such a mark on this world. Thank you for everything you left us to enjoy. And we can't, you have one more gift. You have Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, based on the play by August Wilson, and the in his, I always forget what the cycle is called, but it's a cycle of 10 plays. Is it the Pittsburgh? It might be the Pittsburgh cycle, the Philadelphia. I forget. But can't wait to check it out. I'm sure it's going to be amazing.
Have you ever seen it? The actual play?
Yeah. Oh, no. I've seen. So the thing is, August Wilson is one of the, it's kind of fucked up, but August Wilson, when I was in school, kids, August Wilson was the playwright that, like, you know, whenever a black actor came in, they'd be like, oh yeah, do some August Wilson. And they'd throw you an August Wilson, like every black actor, it's the Pittsburgh cycle. Every black actor got an August Wilson scene. Cause that was the only black playwright that schools knew to.
Fences. That makes sense.
Yeah, no, it's
Fences.
Yeah. It's the Pittsburgh. It's all the plays are all decades in Pittsburgh. So Jitney is the 1970s. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is 1920s. Fences is 1950s. Joe Turner's Come and Gone is 1910s. Piano Lesson 1930s. Two Trains Running 1960s. Seven Guitars 1940s. King Headley 1980s. Gem of the Ocean 1900s. And Radio Golf is the 1990s.
So the kind of focus you need to have to see a plan like that through.
Insane.
Is insane.
Insane. Yeah, truly. And I mean, let's be real. I mean, you know, I say that, I mean, August Wilson, easily one of the best playwrights of our time. And those plays are incredible. So I can't wait to see it. But yeah, this has been a nice send off to a truly, truly, truly legendary actor. So thank you, Chadwick.
Yeah.
And Alex, you take care of yourself, buddy.
You too, Professor.
Little justice.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org, because only together we rise.